My name's Dave Robinson. I'm an alcoholic. I got sober on August 28th of 1991. I have a sponsor. I sponsor a couple of guys. I have a home group. It's called the Emory 24-Hour Meeting, and it's conveniently located on Route 91 in Maryland, halfway between Fogelsburg and Finksburg. So I'm sure you've heard of those places, quite metropolis of Carroll County, Maryland. First of all, I just want to say thank you to Carolyn for the warm welcome she's given me. I mean, hospitality on overload, encouraging, just a wonderful person, and really the whole committee. I mean, if you look around these tables, I don't know what you call them, the emojis, think about all the love that went into that. Every one of these tables has 7 or 8 or 10 of these, and somebody had to make these. Somebody had to make them. I mean, what a wonderful experience this has been for me. Humbling, by the way, humbling. Not because of the number of people, not because of the podium, because of who you are. As members of Al-Anon, for the most part, it's humbling. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity. Full disclosure, when I was asked by Marcia, my immediate response, and I have reasons for this, was no. And she said, well, just think it over for a couple days. And I thought about it, and what came to me was that if somebody asked me to do something in a fellowship, I need to say yes unless I have a valid reason not to. But the reason I said no is it's kind of a story in itself, and I can go down rabbit holes in a hurry, and I'll try not to do that today. But with about 20 years of sobriety, I'd spoken a lot. And guys would walk up to me after meetings and pat me on the back and say, man, I got a lot out of what you had to say. And this ego was alive and well. And what I heard was this little man on my shoulder saying, of course they get a lot out of what you have to say. You say good stuff. And because of some things that went on in my sobriety at that point, I really changed directions. And it stopped becoming about me, and it started becoming about a spiritual relationship with a higher power. And I went in a totally different direction in my recovery. I really needed to. So, okay, so now I've kind of laid all my dirty laundry out there. There's three things I want to read. That's what this paper has to do with up here. And anyways, this is from a book that Bill Wilson wrote called The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. And in the foreword of that book, there's one sentence with a whole bunch of commas. It's kind of a good read for a little paragraph. It says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, a lot of commas, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And I can tell you, if you came from where I came from, the idea of being happily and usefully whole wasn't something I really cared about. And I can tell you there's another part of that sentence there that says, if practice is a way of life, which that's telling me is, and I think you can apply all this to any 12-step fellowship, Al-Anon or AA. I can't speak with any authority on that, but I think if all I do is go to meetings, the only thing that's going to change about me is my breath. I don't have any chance of staying sober if that's all I'm doing. It's just coming in here and taking up a seat. I've got to make this thing a way of life. Just to go back to the beginning, give you a little bit of background. My parents were both born in 1922. They were both raised on farms. My mother was one of 10 children of Slovak immigrants that farmed in northern PA. All 10 kids were born on the farm. A very Catholic, very spiritual family. I always felt like I measured up, like they loved me almost unconditionally in that family. Didn't feel that at home, didn't feel that at school. My father's family, same kind of scenario, but his dad was a farmer and way up in the mountains of Western North Carolina. And when you say they farmed back in those days, they farmed with a draft horse and a mule. It was a very hard life, and on that farm, I really found a place where I absolutely fit in. And my granddad loved me exactly as I was. They would look at me doing a math problem and say, "Did you see what that old boy can do?" And he's really smart, isn't he? And no matter what I did, it was just seemed to be wonderful for them. And it's a very important thing for me to remember. And my parents tried to teach me gratitude. I remember my mom praying at night with me, saying, you know, you should thank God for this, thank God for that. And I just missed it. I missed the idea of gratitude in my life. And my brother and I would come downstairs on a Christmas morning, for instance, and we'd kind of look around, and, you know, neither one of us ran down them steps and went, wow, there's a box down here. Maybe one of them's for me. No. We just both looked around, counted boxes, sorted them out by name tags. If I got four, he should have four. He has a big box, I should have a big box. We're opening gifts. I'm staring at what he's getting. He's staring at what I'm getting. No sense of gratitude. The other thing that I grew up with was this idea of comparison. And I don't know where all this stuff came from. I mean, I have daddy issues for sure, but I mean, don't we all, you know? And I really don't know where this came from, but from a very young age, I mean, young age, nothing was good enough. Nothing that life put in front of me measured up to what I thought it should be. And a story about that. We were playing basketball one day, and a bunch of guys from the neighborhood, and I was raised in Baltimore County, north of Baltimore, and playing basketball. And this one guy says to my brother, he says, "That's really cool what Dave told us, Rich, about your dad, you know?" And my brother looked at me and looked at him and says, "What did he tell you?" He says, "Well, your dad works for the FBI, plus he's in the Secret Service." My brother said, "No, he's not. He works at the Brunning Highway General Motors Factory. He's not a secret agent." And they busted me, but I came up with more lies to try to make it believable. It was undercover. That was just his cover. And it wasn't good enough for me that my dad worked 10 or 12 hours a day in a factory to support us. That wasn't quite enough. I wanted Sean Connery. I wanted 007 for a dad. So when that's your framework, you know, and you're raised in a religion, somehow in this religion, I got this great concept of going into this, I don't know, little room with a guy, a priest, and I was supposed to tell him the things that I did that I really shouldn't have done that past week. Kind of like a fourth and a fifth step inventory. And I did that once. One time. I went in, I told him the truth. I stole something from a five and dime. And that guy looked at me. I couldn't see him. It was dark. But he says, "Okay, I want you to go to the five and dime and tell him you stole from him. Pay him back. And then go home and tell your parents. And I want you to say 10 of these prayers and 10 of those prayers." And I thought, first of all, prayer now is a penance. It's a punishment. It's not about a relationship. That was where I got my idea of what prayer was. And I thought to myself, I am never going to tell that guy the truth again. And every time I went in that booth, I lied. Every time. I wanted to make sure I only got five of these prayers and two of these. I wanted to make sure I got up from that prayer rail just as quick as the other kids, because if I stayed there too long, you knew I was dirty. And that set a foundation in my life. No gratitude, nothing's good enough, and you can't ever know who I am. How's that for 10 years old? That grandfather I just told you about, if I talk long enough about him, I'll start crying, so I'm not going to, but I just love that man. And when he died, I almost immediately quit singing in the choir. I was a choir boy. I quit Boy Scouts. And I just, hindsight's 20/20. At the time, I had no idea any of this was happening. But I no longer had a place on the face of the earth where I could go to where I felt like I fit in. He was gone. And it was the end of my world. And I fell in with people who accepted me. They accepted me for who I was. And they did a lot of drinking, a lot of drugs, some criminal stuff. And I fell right in with them. I would do anything anybody put in front of me. And I have no idea what time it is. Okay, there it is. I would do anything anybody put in front of me. By the time I was in the ninth grade, I'd been kicked out of school. My parents had to go to the Board of Education to have me reinstated for a bunch of stuff I did. And I go to my wall locker, and I pull a brown paper bag out of it, and it's got six full bottles of beer that I stole somewhere, put in the wall locker at school. I mean, how smart is that? And the vice principal's chasing me down the hall saying, stop, come back here. I'm like, man, I'm beating feet out of the building. And so, I mean, I was a mess. And I OD'd on dope when I was in the ninth grade. And what happened from that experience was drugs scared me so bad. That's why I say I'm an alcoholic. I am not a drug addict. If I was being raised right now, I'd be a statistic, because anything you stuck in front of me, I did it. And that overdose scared me so bad, I just dedicated the rest of my life to drinking. So I'm already trying to adjust the substance I need to stop this stuff going on in my head. I'm already adjusting it so that I don't die. So, and at the time, you know, Vietnam was happening, and my brother was protesting the war, and he was in college, and he had an SDS, little penny war, Students for a Democratic Society, and my father would just go at it with him, and boy, the veins would be popping out in there. And they just figured, if all Dave's doing is puking in the backyard at 2 in the morning on Saturday night, that's okay, we'll leave him alone. He's not like these communists. So they really left me alone and just let me drink. And my problem with relationships started back then. I mean, I don't know what dating is when you're 17 or 16 years old. Well, I do. It's really not dating, but chasing, the chase. And, you know, I was always trying to beat a round peg in a square hole, always, my whole life. And then nothing, you know, just so. I went to Marine Corps. I was getting out of Marine Corps after 5 years. And a lot of stuff happened when I was in the Marine Corps. And I looked at my medical records years later. And there's several entries in there at like 1 a.m. or 3 a.m. I'm getting stitched up for this or stitched up for that or a broken bone. And it's always like right around closing time is when this stuff is happening. But so when I was getting out, my liver was starting, it was damaged. I was a little jaundiced, and I was a sergeant in the Marine Corps, and this 03, he was the lieutenant in the Navy, the doctor. He says, well, Sergeant, your liver's damaged, and I'm going to have to keep testing you over a period of time, and we'll have to figure out what to do, but your discharge is going to be on hold until we get this straightened out. I thought, can they do that? I don't know if they can do that to this day, but he scared me enough, so I said, well, you know, he says, go 30 days without drinking. And I'll retest, and if the numbers start to come down, I'll send you to the VA hospital back home. So, and he said, here's phone numbers, these two or three guys that get together on base. Call them, because you might have a hard time quitting. This is in the 70s. I got sober in 91. So you might have a hard time quitting. And I remember looking at this guy, and now I'm an enlisted man. This is an officer, right? And I'm a Marine. He's in the Navy, so I know about discipline. And when he said that to me, I kind of cocked back. And I said, are you calling me an alcoholic? What am I going to do next? Am I going to punch this guy and go to Leavenworth? But he picked that nerve. And he said, I can't call you an alcoholic, but one sign of alcoholism is when a person's body is damaged due to their consumption of alcohol. Your body is damaged, and I highly suspect it's from your consumption of alcohol. And when I walked away from that guy, I took that piece of paper he gave me with three guys' names to get together on base and talk about not drinking. I made sure I was within sight of him when I threw it in the trash can. Came back, got retested, came home, and when I got back home, I went to the VA hospital like I was told to do. And I walked in there, and there was a room full of people, young people, old people, black people, white people, rich, poor, homeless. And I remember looking in that room thinking, I don't know what these people are doing, but there's one thing they got in common. They all got an L for loser on their forehead. I don't have anything in common. I'm out of here. I got up and talked to the nurse. Said, look, I got an honorable discharge. Do I have to be here? She says, no, this is for your good. I said, but do I have to be here? She said, no. I said, okay, great. See you. And I walked out. 4 o'clock the next morning, I woke up in West Baltimore in a blackout because I hadn't drank in about 6-7 weeks. And I went drinking. It was like throwing a match in a bucket of gasoline. Didn't teach me a thing. I remember my mom saying to me one morning, she says, so I lived at home for a few months when I got out. She says, is there something bothering you? I said, no, Mom. Why? She goes, usually when people drink the way you do, there's something really bothering them. So, you know, I had all these little things that would happen along the way, and I don't know. I had a girl that worked at a bar, and we ended up living together, and she kicked me out because of my drinking. I would do, well, one night she was standing in front of a china cabinet, and I threw a plate into the china cabinet. It was like a big explosion. I wanted to get her attention. I never knew what day was going to come out of me. So I got this apartment. I'm sitting in that apartment. It's like 1980s, something or other. So I'm moving along here, folks, by the way. So I'm up at like 82 or so. I'm moving this apartment by myself, and it's long weekends coming up. Excuse me. And I'm thinking to myself, I need a break. What was happening then, I didn't know at the time. It's hindsight. It was like I had a different cassette tape that went into my brain. I would think about this girl that broke up with me and how she hurt me and she wronged me. I'd think about this guy at work that would never acknowledge me. I'd think about somebody got promoted, didn't deserve their promotion. They're called resentments. I didn't know what they were, but I fed on them. It's what kept me going. It's what gave me a reason to live, was to hate you and hope bad things would happen to you. But I couldn't even accept or admit that. But from all that chatter in my head, something happened to me around that time frame where I just wanted to be left alone. The fun was over with drinking. I drank for purpose. I drank to stop the noise, leave me alone. So I'm in this apartment. I got a three-day weekend. I'm going to two or three different liquor stores because people are starting to say, you just bought a case yesterday. And I don't like that because they're challenging me. They're like that doctor in the Navy. So I'm changing liquor stores. So I get into this apartment. I got like a bunch of booze. I don't remember what it was. Frozen pizzas, all kind of food, a carton or two of cigarettes. I got a three-day weekend. I call the two friends I have left, and I tell them both lies about where I'm going to be for the weekend. I take the phone off the wall because it was a wall phone. Closed the curtains, and I walked around in my underwear for 3 days watching cable TV, getting drunk until I passed out, and then waking up and doing it all over again. And I can remember, I can stand here today and tell you, I consciously remember thinking, God, this is great. This is great. This is my reward. It's all the noise has stopped. Just leave me alone. Leave me alone and let me drink. I go to work, they're making comments about my breath in the morning. You know, I can't really hang on to a girlfriend because of this personality issue I have. And, of course, then I thought it was their personalities. But so I met this really interesting. So I would sober up enough to take a hostage. And what I did when I took a hostage was, if I was interested in you, what that means, I would let you see who I thought you wanted me to be. See, so when I look in a room full of people in Al-Anon, I kind of understand the manipulation you've lived with. I get it, because I did it. I did it, and I own that part of my life. But I can remember what I wanted her to see was this guy, right? This guy, James Bond guy, right? So we go up there, and I'm just thinking, this is great. So I get tickets to Zorba the Greek with Anthony Quinn at the Lyric Theater in Baltimore. And before that, we're going to go to the Hilton Inn or the Pikesville Inn, someplace for a restaurant where they have waiters that use little ash dustpans and they sweep your table off. They sweep your tablecloth off because I want her to think that's my normal Friday night. And it worked. It worked. And So we met in September, got engaged at Christmas, and we were having a before the wedding. These guys wanted to take me out for drinking right before the wedding. It wasn't a bachelor's party. It was just like a get-together. And I told her, I said, you know, these guys are going to try to get me drunk. So here's how we need to work this. This is what we need to do. Because I know a couple of these guys, they're going to mix stuff up. They're going to get me. So this is what, you drive me to work, drop me off, because you're off that day, that Friday. And then you come and get me at Brown's Pub out on Route 40, Ellicott City, where I worked at the time. And you come get me, I said, and get there at 9 or 9:30 at the latest. Don't you just get there at 9 or 9:30 because they're going to try to get me drunk. And she hadn't really seen me trashed in all that time. Remember what I said? If I want something, you're not going to see until I get you completely where I want you, where I'm controlling you. Then you're going to see what I'm all about. Not until then. So I just, you know, I'm, I, She comes in there, and apparently some of this is kind of hazy, but the owner of the place said he can stay if you sit between those guys, two kind of larger guys. And I was a lineman at the time, and I hung with that kind of guy, those guys, and sat me down between two friends of mine. And he said, if he gets up, I'm calling the police. And tell him when he gets sober, if he comes back in here, I'm calling the police on him. I pulled a guy off a bar stool. Apparently, it was kind of a scene. And when Wanda came in to get me, I don't remember what all happened or who was sitting there. But we went out and got in a truck, and she drove home. And I couldn't quite get the door all the way open on Route 70 to puke, going 55 miles an hour. Some of it went outside. Some of it stayed inside. When we got up to Phoenix, where we were living, up above the reservoir in Phoenix, Maryland, and I remember sliding down a hill behind a house. And I don't know about you, but if it's March and you're drunk and you've been vomiting, there's nothing better than damp 35-degree peat moss to lay your face in. And I'm laying down the bottom of this hill, and just like being in that apartment. God, this is great. Just leave me alone. Let me lay here. It's not going to be freezing tonight. I'll be okay. And she's up there yelling. And what she said something about, I'm going to get Doug to come help you. I hated Doug. I got up and I punched a tree because I thought it was Doug. The next morning at 10 o'clock, I'm out there with a bucket of water wiping down the door and the inside of that truck. So, and we got married, I don't know, a week or two later. And a lot of stuff happened in my life over those years. And when I got married, I wanted to be the dad that my grandfather was to me. That's what I wanted to be with everything in my being. I did not want to be the drunk. I did not want to be the guy who went down the basement with a wife and two kids upstairs who loved him. And all they ever wanted from me, and never demanded it, they wanted my love. And I couldn't give it to them. Because I can't stop what's going on up here. I can't. The only way I can stop it is to get drunk. And I have to go down there, be in the basement in the dark by myself with headphones on, listening to Lynyrd Skynyrd with a candle burning. And I remember several times, coming to and seeing my wife's feet there, trying to get me awake to come upstairs to go to bed. She looked at me one day and she says, I'm the reason you drink the way you do, aren't I? And she was crying. She says, I'm the reason you drink the way you do, aren't I? It's my fault. I looked at her as stone cold as I could be. I said, damn right it is. If you get off my back, I wouldn't drink half as much as I do. And I walked back down that basement. My kids at the time, my daughter was born. They didn't know what kind of heart defect she had. And she had other issues. My wife was still working outside the home. She's away. The refrigerator's only got a couple of beers. I can't drink her wine or she'll know. Only a little bit of vodka left in the bottle. I got to go to the bar. I've burped that kid. I fed her. I changed her. I burped her. I burped her again. Made sure she didn't need to be changed. And I laid her down in that crib. Back then they had these Fisher-Price monitors. Microphone on one end, speaker on the other, right? So you could walk around the house. 9-volt battery powered them. And I'm carrying the speaker. The bar is only 2 miles from my house. Booze was so important to me. What I thought, if she vomits and chokes on it, I know CPR, it'll be okay. And I meant it. Because I can't stop this stuff. I can't make it go away. And I need to go where I need to go. And she's sitting over there today. 14 years sober herself. And you can't have that kind of stuff pile up on you year after year, day after day, and go on. You can't. I would sit in that basement and think about suicide over and over with my grandfather's revolver that he carried when he was a deputy sheriff in the mountains of Carolina doing prohibition. I was sitting to look at that pistol and want to do what I needed to do to stop it. That was the only thing left for me. I remembered thinking about my brother. And my brother was an alcoholic. But he was a drunk. I could look at him. And see, as far as I was concerned, alcoholism was just a clinical name that people used to excuse their inexcusable behavior. I did not think that alcoholism was a thing. I thought it was something a coward used to excuse his cowardice. He didn't have character. Alcoholism ain't a real thing. They're making this stuff up. And thought, yeah, it's just what he does. I wanted the big, he wasn't the bright big brother for me either. I wanted the big brother that could fight for me and stand up for me. I didn't want to be the guy picking him up out of the gutter like I had to do. I could hold my booze, see? He couldn't. If he's an alcoholic, I'm not. So I would take him to meetings sometimes, give him a ride, because the court told him he had to go to meetings. I'd drop him off to meetings. Say, wasn't that Mr. Gordon up there I saw at the door? He said, I can't tell you who comes to these meetings, Dave. If you want to find out, you got to come inside. So I knew my anonymity was protected in this fellowship. Very important. I don't know about Al-Anon, but I can tell you, in AA, it's very important. It's sacred. And I learned that from him. And, excuse me. And the other lesson I learned from him was if this miserable drunk who drinks cream de mint in the morning, I mean, the hand sanitizer of today, he would have never gone to a bar. He would have drank, I mean, he drank anything that had alcohol in it. If he could get sober, I knew, okay, I was raised Catholic. I knew at the time. At the time, I thought, if I commit suicide, I'm going to hell because you can't die with that kind of a sin on your soul. And I thought, I don't know if I believe that or not, but it's certainly not going to be a good thing. I probably won't feel it. But how can I die with dignity and leave those two babies upstairs and that wife that never wanted anything from me but love? I couldn't do it. I paced back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I called AA up and I said, look, this guy on the hotline, thank God there's a hotline. And he said, well, I said, look, I don't know what I am, but I have to stop drinking. If I don't quit drinking, I'm a dead man. Do you understand? He says, well, do you want me to send somebody to your house? No, 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 no. I don't want anybody coming to my house. But I'm going to check this thing out. I just need somebody to show me how to not drink. There's nothing else wrong. Not drink, right? So he says, well, where do you live? I said, Carroll County. He says, we get many meetings in Westminster. They're all over Carroll County. I said, no, 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 no. I said, I can be anywhere in Baltimore City 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is what I was doing at the time for my career, my job. And he says, well, there's meetings in West Baltimore. I said, no, no. He says, what about Towson up north central? I said, no. I said, give me something in East Baltimore. I'm west of Baltimore, like 40 minutes. I want to be on the east side of the city so I know there's no chance of running into anybody who knows me. Remember that. My pride is what led him to tell me to go to St. Anthony's Church on Frankfort Avenue off Bel Air Road. So I showed up at that meeting. I've been crying. I was very different at the time. I mean, physically. And I just presented a certain kind of guy, and full beard, a lot of dark hair, a lot of it. And I walked up to the door, and I was shaking. I was so scared. I mean, for the first time in my life, I was going to let a human being know that I'm not perfect. And I don't mean just a little bit imperfect. I mean, these are alcoholics. I was embarrassed to have the brother I had. And I'm going to walk in a room full of these people? God, and this good-looking girl opened the door and said, welcome. And I thought, this might not be too bad. She was hot. And she's still sober, by the way. And I just remember, I had this idea. Well, this would be great. I'll go sit next to her. And I'll just lay my head on her shoulder, and she'll pat my head. And it'll be okay, honey. And she walked me in a room, taught me the first lesson I had in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I should have listened to her. She said, you need to sit up here with the men. Let me get you a cup of coffee. I sat down between two old guys, Carl and Wally. And she came back with half a cup of coffee. And Funny thing happened. They ended up calling on me. This guy named Sonny was speaking at the meeting. He died with 53 years of sobriety. He called on me, and I said, I said, my name's Dave. I don't really know what I am, but I have to stop drinking. And I'm here. I'm hoping you got an answer. A basket came around. All I had was a five. And Carl, and I said, is a five okay? He said, yeah, five's great. Throw it in. So I threw $5 in the basket. And something happened to me that day. Remember that VA hospital I told you about? Well, that AA meeting, black people, white people, young people, old people, women, men, a Catholic nun was in that AA meeting. They had a sign up on the wall. It said, you are not alone. The first time in my life I felt like a part of the human race was in an AA meeting, meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked around in that room, and I didn't see the differences. What I saw was, this is a room full of 55 cigarette-smoking people that have an answer. I don't have to die. I don't have to die. And I threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous in the way. People gave me suggestions. I took them all. I took them all. I got one sobriety date because of those people at St. Anthony's. And I'm going to try to get through this. There's two old guys, Carl and Wally. I went to that meeting Thursday and Friday. I didn't get back there again until the next Thursday. And Carl owned a TV repair shop, and Wally was a roofer in the city. And on the side of his truck, he had painted, here comes Wally, W-A-L-L-E-E. And he was a character, man. He was a character. Older guy, probably younger than me now, but he's the older guy. And I came in that next week, and Wally looked at me, and he says, where were you, kid? I said, well, I live in Carroll County. I'm trying to get down here during the day. I said, I'm going to meetings up there at night. He looked at me and said, that's all right, kid. We said a prayer for you before the meeting. And I looked at him and I smiled, that sarcastic kind of smile. And I looked at Carl. Carl says, that's right, we did. And they both shook their head. These two guys had no idea who I was, but they knew this was a life or death disease. This was not a game to them. They knew I wasn't there to get out of trouble. They knew I was there to save my life. And they were there for me every minute. Every minute. I remember talking to Wally one day on the phone. I said, well, I am shaking every morning. I just get up, my hands are kind of quivering. He says, you ain't that bad, kid. You just got the sugars. Keep ice cream in your house. Drink some orange juice. You ain't that bad, boy. And I just took a lot of suggestions. My sobriety took off, and they gave me that big book, and I just consumed it. And I got to that chapter to the wives. Yeah. Chapter to the wives in the big book. We all know about that in Al-Anon, don't we? And I went home with that big book, and I even got her a copy, my wife. I said, you need to read the chapter to the wives. I have a life or death terminal illness, and you need to know how to treat me. You could say the wrong thing and I could drink and die. You need to go to Al-Anon. You need to get to Al-Anon. It could save my life. I mean, I'm looking out for her. I don't want that guilt on her heart killing me. Saying the wrong thing. So she did what a dutiful wife would do. She went to Al-Anon and oh, boy, oh, boy. Oh, gee. I really dove into this program, and I did it all, you know. And I'm going to fast forward about 20 years in AA. I did a lot of stuff. I started AA meetings. I was very active at first. My wife said, whatever you need to do to get sober, you go do it. She got hobbies. She got into dog agility. She was found her own existence while I was the AA guy. I went to 10, 15 meetings a week. I felt safe in AA. And thank God I had the freedom to do that. So I was running, going to AA meetings. And I'm doing all the stuff, you know. But my life is like, I heard about spreadsheets, right? So I like spreadsheets. I was in engineering department for a long time, and we just love spreadsheets. So put them in a database, and they do all kind of mystical things. So basically, I had a to-do list in AA. I wanted to do all this stuff. I wanted to check all the boxes off, sponsor this many guys, start new meetings, go to so many meetings a week, do all this stuff. And then over here, I had this, okay, I'm gonna enlarge my spiritual growth because this AA God isn't good enough. It's not quite as, you know, I know where the one true God is. I'm going to go back to church. I'm doing a lot of stuff in church and got very active in church. There's nothing wrong with service work. There's nothing wrong with being active in a church. I'm not putting any of that down. It's the reason. For me, it was two spreadsheets, two check-off lists. And at the end of the day, 20 years of sobriety, I had no relationship with God. None. It was all about me. So when those guys would say, I got a lot of what you have, of course you did. I had to memorize talk. I mean, I knew when I said this, that one over there is going to cry. And they're going to laugh back there when I say this. And at this point, I'll do this. At that point, I'll do that. And I'll be very entertaining. And I can promise you, I'm not up here tonight today to entertain you or to impress you. So I was just in a bad place. And I made some decisions that just call it a midlife debacle. And for the lack of any other terminology. And it was a self-centered nightmare. And I walked away. I just quit working. I just quit my job. I had a great career. Had a nameplate outside my office. Lots of business cards. And when I was talking in AA meetings, I could say all the catchy phrases. And I could regurgitate from the big book verbatim. And I knew how to do all that. And I'd impress the living dickens out of you. So I just fell apart is what happened. And didn't know if I wanted to be married. Didn't know if and I looked at my wife and we had a conversation and she says, well, if you want to work on this, I'm here. Work on it. So I got into therapy. And the biggest thing I did was I threw myself back into Alcoholics Anonymous. Saw a psychologist a couple times a week. Or actually, it ended up being every 2 weeks for a year, year and a half. He helped put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And I got very active in AA. And I thought, I've missed something. I don't know what. But everybody tells me how great I am. Why am I trashing the rest of my life? Why am I throwing it all away? And I found out about that relationship with God that was missing. You know, I mean, I just to backtrack a little bit, when I was about 14 years sober, my wife and I would go, and just the thoughts that get up here to justify, rationalize unjustifiable behavior. We would go out to dinner maybe three times a year. We'd go to a nice restaurant like, you know, Chipperelli's in Little Italy in downtown Baltimore. But we would go three times a year, maybe four. Where the place where the time when you go out to dinner, it's $100, $150 back then. I don't know what it is now. Well, somebody took us out not long ago. It was $400 and something, but I didn't pay it. So we're in this restaurant, and I'm 14 years sober, and this thought came to my mind. You know what? I looked at my wife, and I back then we would dress up when we went out to dinner. It was like because it was an affair three times a year, right? Big deal, you know. So we're sitting there at Chipperelli's in Little Italy. I looked at her. I said, "You know what? I believe I'm going to have a glass of wine with my dinner." She says, "Well, how's this going to work? I mean, Dave, really, where are you going to live?" And something like in that midlife period, you know, she said, "My lifestyle's not going to change." And she said that day, she says, "Where are you going to live?" And I said, well, you don't understand. You don't get it. You ready for this? I said, "You don't understand. I've worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The slate has been wiped clean. I would not be drinking for a reason. I don't have resentments. I would just be drinking to enhance the meal." She says, "Well, how much would you drink?" And now I'm into it. This is not a joke now. This is dead serious. I said, "Well, I would only drink there two or three glasses, maybe one bottle of wine with dinner." And I said, "And we would only go out to a really nice restaurant maybe once a week." So my $500 a year budget has now turned into $6,000 a year so that I can drink a bottle of wine with dinner when I go out to eat. And I'm not going to drink other than that. And I never drank wine at all. But I was trying to justify and make an excuse to drink wine. So, you know, so when I got to this place in my recovery, in my soberness, my dryness, I started trying to put things together, and I threw myself back into AA, and I started sponsoring new guys. And what I discovered was, without that relationship with God, I'm a dead man. I'm a dead man, because I can tell you one thing. I will not be able to go on if I lose the respect of my children or my wife. If I do something because of my self-centered behavior and I lose their love and respect, I'm dead. I am checking out. If it's on me. And so I looked around with that kind of desperation. I started throwing myself back in here. Man, if you stood still, if you were a newcomer and you stood still long enough after a meeting, I was on top of you. I mean, I was ready to start helping you. And I chased them. I would call them. I drove one guy, you remember him, I won't say his name, but I drove him to meetings 7 days a week. And I was talking to other people the same. I'd be up in a tree stand bow hunting, and my phone would vibrate, and I'm talking to newcomers while I'm in a tree stand. I gotta go, one's coming. super active. And I was doing it for all the right reasons, you know. And that brother of mine, he and I stood back in 2002, stood on either side of the bed when my mother was dying, breathed her last breath. And he and I had reconciled, and we held hands. We each held one of my mom's hands as she took her last breath. And when she did, we embraced and bawled our eyes out. That was the guy that I was ashamed of as my brother. And we could stand there and live through that and experience it together the way a brother is supposed to love his brother. And, you know, I learned a lot from him. I never told him. I couldn't tell him. 2 years sober, he pulled in my driveway. I'm going back a little bit about my brother. 2 years sober, he pulls in my driveway. I said, Richard, I can't keep lying to you. My whole family thought I just quit drinking. The rule was, don't tell anybody I'm going to AA. They can't know it. 2 years sober, I couldn't live that lie anymore. He pulled in the driveway. I said, Richard, I've been lying to you and the whole family. I said, in some ways, I got worse than you ever were. And I said, I couldn't quit on my own. I went to AA. You know what he said? That's great, Dave. That's great. No resentment. I'm lying on him, making him feel bad about himself because he couldn't do what I could do. And he had no resentment. He looked at his wife, and we talked a little bit. He looked at his wife and says, hey, Beth, guess what? Dave's sober in AA just like we did. And he knows Dudley, and he knows Lamar. He knows all the old-timers in Baltimore. That meeting I went to, the reason I went to that meeting was because of my fear. Because of that wall of pride, I didn't want anybody to see me that knew me, to where my brother got sober. I was 2 years sober, and a guy walked up to me. He says, you got a brother named Richard? And he says, every now and again, it's something about you. I thought I recognized something. I said, yeah, his name Richard. And he says, I was his first sponsor. And I'd known this guy for 2 years. And had no clue. And during this period of time, I got a phone call 3:00 in the morning during this kind of midlife trying to dig back into AA. Got a call 3:00 in the morning from his wife. Said, your brother drove up into a Pennsylvania State game lane and blew his brains out with his grandfather's pistol. 31 years sober. He was a minister in a Pentecostal church. He checked all the boxes. He checked off all the boxes on the spreadsheet. Suicide. 2 years after his suicide, his wife, his widow, said, I didn't want to tell you this right afterwards, Dave, but the trooper told me, and he had not taken a drink in 31 years. the trooper told her, stuffed neatly down in between the seat and the medium thing, was a half-empty bottle of Jack Daniels that he wrapped up neatly in a brown paper bag and stuffed at her. The last thing he wanted to do was taste alcohol. Tell me this thing doesn't go into my soul. Tell me this is just a bad habit. The last thing he did before he blew his brains out was took a drink. So I learned quite a few lessons from him, you know. So I'm certainly not going to end on that note. you know, my life today is it's about investing in recovery. It's about trying to find that relationship. And I'm telling you what, I have done everything you can do in AA wrong. The only thing I've done right is I haven't drank. I've done it. And what I can tell you is I've always kept one foot in recovery in the rooms of AA. I've never completely left. I've thought about drinking in AA. You know, people talk about spirituality and this relationship with God. It's like, I'm not spiritual. I'm going to AA meetings. I'm checking out all the women. I'm not thinking about God when I'm in an AA meeting. And it's like trying to find that balance and trying to move in a spiritual direction. The answers were right here in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's a taste of it from the 10th step. 10th step in the Big Book of AA has 4 paragraphs. 2 of them are instructional. There's only 2 instructional paragraphs in the Big Book on 10th step. Here's the first one I'm going to go over, just touch on a little bit. It says, our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. It is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, not if, but when they crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anybody. That doesn't talk about going to a spiritual retreat once a year and making a list and doing a 4th and 5th step. I'm supposed to be able to recognize this stuff when it's happening, if I'm having that relationship with God. And it tells me in there where the answer is. I'm supposed to ask God to remove them. I missed it. Here's the part, the other thing on that 10th step that really was just such an awakening to me. The other page, it says, what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Well, if you don't have any spiritual condition, you're not maintaining anything. You're just going through the motions, making a good image. This is, and people say there's no musts, right? Well, here's 2. Here's 2 musts for you. Every day, not occasionally, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. That's a goal. I'm telling you, that's an objective for me that I am never going to hit. I'm not. But I can tell you what happened to me with 30 years, or might have been last year. I don't know. It was pretty recent. It wasn't that long ago. When I started reading these paragraphs every morning, in that period of time when I'm supposed to be into prayer and meditation, but it ends up on an iPad and I'm looking at this and like, so I read that and I'm thinking, okay, I have to have a vision of God's will for me. I think I'm going to think about this today. And maybe I do once today and once on Tuesday, right? But I will remember it at some point during the week. So I'm thinking about that, a vision of God's will for me. And I got to think about it constantly. So it means while I'm walking around. So my wife and I walk a couple miles a day out on Emory Church Road, and we're walking out there. She said something that I didn't agree with, and my normal reaction would be to react. And I'd read this paragraph that day, and I'm walking, and I was getting ready to say something. Yeah, I always had to say the thing my whole life, and I was getting ready to speak. And I didn't hear a voice, don't get me wrong, but this thought came into my mind, that's not God's will, shut up. And it was shocking to me to the point where I almost stopped dead in my tracks. I had never experienced that. 30 years sobriety. Got carrying a Medicare card. I'm not a kid. First time in my life, I almost stopped dead. And I thought to myself, don't stop. Because if you do, and I'm walking, don't stop. Because if you do, she's going to ask you why. And you're going to tell her. And then she's going to have the goods on you. And then she's going to expect you to act this way all the time. Some years before, and I knew that's how it works, because some years before that, I was getting ready to celebrate, right at the end of that midlife stuff, getting ready to celebrate 20 years, 21, I don't know, something like that. And I'm walking around trying to become a spiritual giant that night in my house, and apparently I wasn't. And she looked at me and says, "Dave, after all these years, does it really still have to be about you all the time? Still, after all these years, it has to be about you?" I remember thinking, that's a hell of a thing to say to a spiritual giant getting ready to give his speech. It's a hell of a thing. Nobody in AA treats me that way. They love me. God, beat me to death and stuff. So, you know, I don't know what else I can tell you. I can tell you that my life today, you know, like I said, my daughter's got 14 years of sobriety. That wasn't supposed to happen. Wanda will tell you a little bit about that. My son at one point, somebody last night talked about jacking their son up, you know, and I probably used to do that too, but now that would be, that would end badly. It'd be worse than me trying to, well, it'd be the same as me trying to jack Corey up, my son-in-law. So it's like, but he and I were best friends, my son and I. We went hunting everywhere, New Brunswick, all over Canada, went salmon fishing. We did a lot together. He's my best friend. He was disrespectful to his mother over and over again, and he had a fifth of whiskey or tequila or something in his closet. And I warned him a couple times. I said, "Dude, you got 60 days to find a place to live. You're out." I said, there's no conversation about this. You're out." And don't get me wrong. I knew he had a place to go, and I knew it was going to be debauchery, but I didn't care. He had to get out, and it broke my heart. He just, to this day, does not know how many nights I cried. I wanted to take that back. I wanted to take those words back so bad. But today, he brings my grandkids down to our house every Friday, and we babysit them. We have a relationship today. You know, my daughter and son-in-law and my wife and I, we're getting ready in a couple weeks. We're going to drive up to Northern Ontario if it ain't burned down yet. and we've been up there before, and we're gonna drive up to this place where they put you on a little airplane called a Beaver. De Havilland Beaver. They're going to fly us up to this 8-mile long lake that has one cabin on it. And it's got two boats with outboard motors. I'd like to do the little effect, special effect. And we're going to fish for walleye and pike for a week in a cabin with no cell service, limited other amenities. This is the life I'm, this is what I wanted. Today, there's not a lot of stuff that I want, but I want everything I have. I love my wife. Been married 38 years. You know, I love my kids. I'm proud of my daughter. Very proud of her. You know, I have this life that I never dreamt of today. And I have Alcoholics Anonymous to be grateful for it. And I'll tell you my Al-Anon piece here of all this, a few minutes left. Back in that midlife thing, when I told Wanda, I said, I got to get my head screwed on right. And she says, "Why don't you go to Al-Anon with me?" I said, "Yeah, okay." I mean, I was willing to do anything. So we went to an Al-Anon meeting, and I'm the guy that always has all the answers. We left that first Al-Anon meeting Sunday night, driving home, and I said, "I can't believe those people. That one woman had her kid in rehab 8 times. What the hell's the matter with her? Kick them out." I'll tell you what happened. About 5 meetings later, I listened to those same people and I thought, you know what, Slick? I wouldn't have a clue either. I wouldn't have a clue either. And people started saying things to me that just touched me. Thelma, who's now deceased, she was 90-some years old, you know, she said, "Wait, what's that mean?" It means, "Why am I talking?" And I remember hearing that and thinking, well, why am I talking? Well, it's to hear me. Most of the time, it's to hear me. I mean, Al-Anon is the reason my son never beat me up in my old age. I've learned when to shut up. Sometimes. Not all the time. Sometimes. And I really do credit Al-Anon with those relationships. There was a guy that was in Al-Anon full time, and I probably went to meetings 5 years. We did some stuff with Alateen, and this guy was in there. He was from Czech, and I was talking to him at a meeting one night, and he says, I said, I hardly ever see you around AA. I said, once, you know, a couple times a month, maybe. He says, Dave, you probably won't like this, but I came to AA to get sober. I come to Al-Anon to learn how to live. And, you know, to me at the time, that was AA blasphemy. But I've come to understand that and appreciate that. I have. And if there's any intuitive nature to things that you hear, my wife the other day said, maybe we ought to go to another Al-Anon meeting together again sometime soon. So I never knew where this journey is going to take me. I tell you, I can't thank you guys enough for having me up here. I didn't want to, you know, have you fearing that I was going to start vibrating when I got up here, but I was about unnerved coming up here. And again, it's because of the audience. I look out here and I see my wife, my kids, I see my parents, I see everybody, me and my alcoholism touched, all the relationships that fell apart. And I think it's a beautiful thing that there's a fellowship called Al-Anon. And I'm glad it was here for me at the time, you know, because there was a lot that went on then that Al-Anon helped me with. And I probably forgot to say about 27 very fascinating things. But I think that's about all I'm going to say for tonight, today, except to just say thank you for this opportunity. And I've gotten much more out of this than you have, I can tell you that. Thank you.